Hi, I'm Dr. Karen Lin. I am the one of the board trustees at the New Jersey Academy of Family Physicians, and we are very honored to invite two speakers, expert in this area. Last time we had the part one, and today we're going to talk about part two. So Dr. Verna Little is a PsyE and licensed social worker, Chief Operating Officer of Concert Health, and also at the Zero Suicide Institute. And Dr. Kate Rivi is a board certified pediatrician in the Princeton area. In the part one, we talk about the screening and assessment patient for suicide risk. And today, our part two, we're going to cover the brief intervention, developing safety plans, and making arrangement with behavioral health practitioners. Dr. Little?
Great. Thank you, Dr. Lin. I'm very glad to be back here and to follow up on our suicide safer care part two. I know last time we spent quite a bit of time talking a little bit with providers about how to identify children who are at risk for suicide and talked a bit about what you might be able to do in your practice to help you identify children at risk, and also talked quite a bit about how pediatric suicide continues to be on the rise in the communities that we serve, both in the state and nationally. So certainly it's more important than ever to really pay attention to what's happening in your practice around suicide and really putting some systems in for suicide safer care. And I think one of the things that we have learned working with pediatric providers is that there are absolutely some things that you can do in your practice when a child or adolescent screens positive for suicide, whether you asked them directly as part of a screening or whether they made a suicidal statement or were brought in to your office for having made suicidal statements or because someone in their life was concerned about them. And one of the things we know is that there's some ways that you can give information out to parents. We talked a little bit about the ASQ tool and the ASQ toolkit on the NIMH website, having a handout for parents and caregivers. That's certainly a point important to be able to do. We also talked a little bit about the ability to assess patients for risk. And now it's important to talk about what happens when you have a child who has supported their thoughts about suicide and what you might be able to do. It's really important to be able to have some resources at your fingertips, such as the lifelines or the text lines, which are really important and often have been shown to be life-saving and certainly effective ways and referral sources for kids or adolescents who are at risk for suicide, as well as maybe giving some tools around websites such as Now Matters Now. And I know that Dr. Rui has taken some steps in her practice in terms of some referrals and some tools to give out to children and parents. So maybe Dr. Rui, just tell us a little bit about what you've started to do in your practice that you found to be helpful.
So if we have a patient who screens positive for suicide risk on the, we have the, I think as we discussed last time, we use like the PHQ-9 for modified for adolescents, which does have the questions at the end that ask specifically about suicide. So first of all, by nature of our practice, where usually there is a parent, you know, or other guardian or family member there with the patient that we can involve in the discussion, which is, you know, in some ways more helpful maybe than with an older adult, maybe where there isn't somebody else there that you can automatically involve. But we, you know, we will address it. We will say, this, you know, we did this screen and it seems like there's some real concern about, you know, your child having a risk for suicide or for, you know, for harming themselves. And we have a safety plan that we use when discussing follow-up. We actually have a handout where it's It's in a drawer in each of the exam rooms. It's a one-page sheet that's printed out that we can use as kind of a template for discussing follow-up plans. And so this safety plan basically validates that we know you've had these feelings and we're concerned about your safety and that your life is valuable. And it talks about recognizing some warning signs and specific moods or situations that might be making things worse for the person, talking about things that they could do to make themselves feel better at that point, and people who care about them that they could call or talk to. And there's specific listed out the call or text lines for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline or the National Hope Line Network, obviously our numbers, and a discussion about keeping the environment safe and trying to get rid of instruments of harm. So, I mean, that's sort of a summary of the safety plan. There's a lot more that we can go into detail on probably each of those, but that's, I think one point of that is that this safety plan is there because so that when you identify somebody that has this suicide risk, you're not like, oh my God, what do I do next?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's really important because what we hear from a lot of providers is I don't ask, right? Because I'm afraid to ask because I'm not sure what to do. So having something there that's handy for providers and having the training so that they know what to do. Here's the importance of safety planning. Here's why we safety plan with patients. And here's a safety plan that we have in our practice that's readily available to you. Because what we know is that children and adolescents are going to come to their primary care provider. More children and adolescents are going to present in primary care with thoughts of suicide than they are likely to go into a community mental health center or to get identified into specialty mental health. And they also have a relationship. Many times they've been coming to their pediatric provider for years. They have a relationship with you. And so oftentimes both them and the parents or caregivers feel more comfortable. And I think it's really important that we have some systems in place so that we're just not, you know, giving patients an 800 number and say, you know, here, call this and hopefully this will be helpful, or just sort of, you know, sending everyone to the emergency room. One of the things is that we need to make sure that we choose appropriate levels of care for everyone. You know, not every child who presents to a pediatric practice with asthma needs to go to the emergency room. And it's really important to figure out an appropriate level of care for all children and adolescents and not just those who don't have thoughts of suicide. And it's really important then to have some systems in place that have some alternatives to the emergency room, because we know sometimes sending people to the emergency room can actually make things worse for them. So we want to make sure that we do it appropriately. And I know, Dr. Rui, we actually talked a little bit before this podcast about some of the things that you've done in your practice. And one in particular is really important is identifying children and adolescents that are at risk, but also how do you continue to care for them? Because they're going to continue to come back to your practice. And so maybe just talk a little bit about some steps that your practice has put in place so that when someone has been identified, you can follow up each time.
So, yeah, I think there's a couple things that I can comment on with regard to that. One is I generally will make, I guess over time, I've kind of come to realize you think that that maybe you don't have that much you can do as a primary care doctor because you're not a psychiatrist and you're not a psychologist. But some of the things that you can do are relatively simple to just make sure that this patient has some tools and some follow-up and knows that somebody cares about them. And I think that can sometimes be as important as, you know, or more effective than sending them to the emergency room, say. So one thing that I generally do is we'll have the patient schedule a follow-up with me, specifically for that reason, to check in on how they're doing. And usually with a short interval, something like within a week or two, you know? I mean, depends a little bit, of course, on every individual situation. The other thing that I think we were talking about a little bit offline was trying to make it clear, especially when you're in a group practice and this person could show up with an ear infection the following week, that this problem was identified. And so we in our EHR have a way to add to the problem list suicide risk or major depression with suicidality or something that identifies in an easy to see way when maybe one of my partners logs in to treat the kid for the ear infection to say, okay, they were just here, you know, a week ago or 2 weeks ago for this. And so that they can, so that they can not just treat the ear infection and get in and get out. I think that's an important part of making, just as you would like with asthma, saying, okay, this person has, you know, moderate persistent asthma. And if they're in with something else, you might check in on them. I think treating suicidality, which is obviously life-threatening, in a similar way.
It also sounds to me like in your practice, providers are sort of given, I don't want to use the word permission necessarily, but that if you have a child or adolescent who's at risk for suicide, then that really does take front and center in terms of what happens in that visit. So maybe speak to, you know, has that been a shift in your practice? Do you, you know, has that changed over time, you know, to really understand and be more comfortable with suicide risk?
I think so. I mean, I think since we've been doing the PHQ screening, which I'm trying to even think of the number of years, it's been years now, but I mean, I've been with the practice for almost 13 years and it hasn't been that entire time that we were doing it. So I think that since we've been using that, you obviously identify your screening. So you identify more people at risk for suicide, and then you kind of become more comfortable dealing with the consequences. And I think, yes, if that's identified during a well visit, I'm not going to be spending a lot of time talking about that they should wear their seatbelt or, put on sunscreen. I think it really does become, not that I don't think those things are important, but right. I'm going to say, okay, full stop. We need to address this. This is the important issue right now. And I think that my partners, I think on almost uniformly, we feel the same way, that yes, it does become kind of the most important thing. And over time you become a little bit more comfortable with, with figuring out a plan. I think the tendency at one point was to, if there was, even before we were screening, if you identified somebody that was at risk for suicide, the kind of automatic thing was to send them to a crisis center or an emergency department. And that, you know, turns out may not be the best thing for them.
Certainly. And, you know, when you think about anticipatory guidance, I really do believe that suicide risk should be taught to children, just, you know, like we talked last time with, you know, when you catch on physical fire, you stop, drop, and roll, you know, what happens, and to teach about suicide and suicide risk early. And I think to build it into anticipatory guidance is actually something I can sort of see coming for pediatric providers. And given when you think that over 8% of high school students have actually attempted suicide, and you figure if your practice sees 100 patients a day, you know, with multiple providers, how many people you actually, you know, children and adolescents you actually have in a week who are at risk for suicide. And so it makes sense to start to think about putting some of these systems in place. I'm wondering, with the pandemic, how it has actually changed what you do, because I know there's been a lot of discussion about the increased mental health needs, certainly the increase in suicide risk. and the transition in pediatric practices around prescribing medications for depression and anxiety. So maybe talk about a shift in your practice and what some of the current thinking is.
Yes. So, and I do think I mentioned this a little bit in our first podcast, but I think it's worth, you know, worth going over again. One thing that our practice did at the, around the time of the pandemic, I mean, I think it was already sort of being put in place a little bit before that, but the pandemic definitely kind of crystallized it as the needs increased and as the access was even more of an issue to other mental health providers. We had partnered with a mental health provider group, a large group in our area, and we had some of the psychiatrists do in services for us. Not that we have never heard of SSRIs or had never prescribed them before, but to kind of go into a little bit more detail about some specific SSRIs and when they might be used and what, you know, what things to consider when starting, when things maybe were beyond our expertise and really should definitely see the psychiatrist. And also kind of established a little bit of a network. I mean, not an official network, but a number that we could call to say, this is, you know, this is our patient. We've seen them today. We're really concerned. We've, you know, done X, Y, and Z, but we really feel they need to see somebody soon. And so that, you know, it takes some legwork, but I think that's worth doing for practices so that you have, you know, you have some place to refer people when they're really in need. And then I think it also allows you to, if somebody is, you know, if somebody has pretty significant depression or anxiety and you think they would benefit from medication, to start them on medication. I know that family practice doctors, who are, you know, our target audience or some of our target audience here, are probably a little bit more, I would assume a little bit more comfortable, and maybe Dr. Lynn can actually comment on that, about prescribing SSRIs, but that's been a shift in our practice in pediatrics, that we now, you know, commonly provide those in the appropriate setting. And I think partnering with this mental health group has been instrumental in that, in getting us comfortable with it. And yeah, and then having a place to send patients where we kind of get where we kind of have an in, so to speak, where we can get patients in more quickly.
That sounds like it's been a tremendous help, and I'm really grateful that they were able to do that for you. That actually sounds like something other practices, you know, around the state or the country might be able to do as well. I know that we only have a few minutes left, and I'm wondering, you know, over the course of these podcasts and some of the discussions around suicide safer care that you've had in relation to doing these podcasts, what's one thing that you might tell other pediatric providers, you know, one piece of advice that you might say if you're going to start to really think about caring for people at risk for suicide differently, identifying, putting some systems together in your practice, you know, what's something that you've learned as a frontline pediatric provider?
Well, I would say, number one, screen. You have to screen, or you're not going to identify these kids. And it's hard to distill it down to one thing, but one thing that I definitely didn't want to let the podcast go by without mentioning, and I think this is a very practical tool that it would be a good place to start for family practice providers or other primary care providers, is the Now Matters Now website. This is a great website, and Dr. Little can probably even provide more information about it, but it is a nice, clear-cut website you can refer somebody to, and it has videos of people who have had suicide attempts or suicidal ideation, and it goes into some of that stop, drop, and roll type of, you know, things that can be done to help reset and help prevent the suicidal ideation from progressing to suicidal attempt. And then also provide some links to concrete training for primary care providers with regard to suicide risk and, you know, follow-up of suicidal patients.
Great. Yeah, thank you. I actually really do like the Now Matters Now website as well. And I know I would often pull it up on a tablet for adolescents because it has some really good stories about people who have had lived experience and some very specific skills that they've learned to be helpful for them, as well as some concrete information for both behavioral health and primary care providers. Dr. Whiteside, the developer there, did really nice work.
Yeah, it's excellent.
I also want to remind all the primary care doctors on this podcast that maybe in your area that, you know, just think about, like Dr. Rivi say, to connect with behavior science practice. We are pretty lucky at Rutgers Health. We work with Rutgers Graduate School of Applied Psychology. So there are psych externs in our practice. And nowadays, there are more and more people that integrated behavior science into primary care. And so that when patients show up in primary care doctor's office, we can give warm handoff. And so again, that we have this two podcasts so far, what every family physician need to know to prevent suicide. And this is sponsored by New Jersey Academy of Family Physicians and the New Jersey Department of Human Services, part of Zero Suicide Initiative. And we really appreciate the two doctors here share your expertise and looking forward to the next three podcasts.